Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Aparuta te sangama tassa dwara. Yeso tuvanto pumunchantu sadhanti. So what is this thing called inspiration? What is it that creates that spark in the mind? What is it that makes the world fresh in the morning? What is it that makes us want to devote ourselves, give ourselves, submit to the Dhamma? There's something about this there's a kind of recognition that happens when we encounter or are reminded of something which has spiritual significance for us. Like, for example, the first Buddhist that I ever met, or the first person that I knew that they were Buddhist. I'm sure I'd met plenty of Buddhists before. But was this lady who was part of our animal liberation group, and I was would have been about maybe 19 or 20. And she had these very clear eyes. She was also like a vegan and used to live in the country and so on. So she did all the right things. I remember at that time I was part of this extreme direct action anarchist fringe group of animal liberation with all these kind of radical atheist anarchist friends and whose idea of a good night out was to go and graffiti on some churches and things like that. I never did that personally. I don't know if they'd ever did it, but they used to talk about it. And even they grudgingly admitted that Buddhism wasn't quite as bad as the other religions. So that was quite something. And I just always remember that this lady had very clear eyes. I'd only met her a couple of times. She came to this kind of fundraising dinner we had at this Vietnamese vegetarian restaurant. And just quite startling, in a way. Maybe it wasn't anything to do with her being a Buddhist. Maybe she was just born with very clear blue eyes, but somehow I kind of noticed it. She was maybe in her 60s or something like that. She had greyish white hair and quite kind of lined tanned sun from somebody who's been out in the sun a lot for most of their life. And then these very glowing clear eyes. And so somehow that evokes this kind of association for me in what Buddhism's about. But that's just me, that's not your associations. But we also have much more general ones, of course. And the symbol of the shaven-headed, brown-robed monks and nuns who are this kind of archetype of the world renouncer. We give up our families, we give up our livelihoods, we give up our worldly possessions. We give up most of the things which we're used to. Give up playing the guitar. And by putting on this robe, I guess there's two aspects to it, the kind of the inner aspect and the outer aspect. And the inner aspect is like what it feels. For each person who puts on the robe will feel very differently about it. And then the other aspect is the external side, is what other people project onto you. And so this can spark something. When someone sees a Buddhist monk or nun, this calls up a very deep image in our minds. There's something, you know, like in the story of the Bodhisattva when he went forth from the palace and he travelled out into the park. He saw a sick man, a dead man, an old man, a dead man, and then finally saw a monk. And then it evoked this response in him. That was like, oh, maybe there is a way out. Maybe there is the possibility of freedom. And so this stirred him very deeply. It called out this spiritual response, which was not, it was deeper than an intellectual level. It was deeper than even an emotional level, but it was more on an existential level. That there was something appealing to his very sense of being or existence, that I am here, I am in this round of birth, aging and death. I'm trapped. I can't get out. I can't see any kind of escape. But maybe there is. Maybe there is something. And so this sight, you know, if we think about it, just on a, not even worrying about whether it actually happened or not, but just on the level of the story of the Buddha's life, that sight unleashed activated this very powerful energy. It made the Buddha decide to leave his home, leave his family, go forth, and to do the same thing, to also shave his head, to also put on the robes, to also walk that same path with that expectation and that hope. So I guess for all of us who have taken robes here, then this is, you know, something similar would have happened to each one of us, whether we know it or not. That, you know, at some time in our lives we would have seen a picture or an image of a monk or nun. I remember I saw, again, just one of these memories from my childhood. I remember seeing a TV program in the 70s that had an interview with a Buddhist nun. Maybe this is why. People ask me sometimes, why are you so concerned with bhikkhunis, and why are you spending so much time to help support the nuns order? And Maybe that's the reason. Maybe the reason is, I had never thought of this before, but maybe that's the reason is because that was the first exposure that I had to the idea of a Buddhist renunciate, an Australian renunciate. She was an Australian nun. I don't know who she was. There mustn't have been very many around at that time. It must have been in the late 70s or early 80s that I saw this. And so that idea kind of planted in my mind. And I remember this sense of wonder around that, of thinking, my goodness, what an incredible thing. What a, you know, what a choice to make in one's life. You know, what, how weird is that? What kind of weirdo would make that kind of choice? But not in a negative way at all, but really in the sense of feeling that there was some kind of very deep level choice that was made to respond in a totally totally sincere and meaningful way to the challenges of life and the mysteries of life and the traumas, the paradoxes, the ambiguities of life, the profundities of life. So that, again, that's that response somehow. And then that kind of plays on the mind in certain ways. It conditions certain perspectives. It influences how we respond in certain situations. And even though we remember that in that story of the Bodhisattvas going forth, that he would go back to his palace and brood. He would brood. I think it's Nijanam or something like that. So he didn't necessarily act straight away, but there's this kind of almost this turbidity in the mind. This kind of energy is activated in the wellsprings of the mind, the kind of the mud which we've allowed to settle at the bottom of our mind has started to be stirred up. Something new is coming in. Something is going to emerge. We don't know what yet, and there's a fear there. We're afraid of what it could be, because there are dangerous things lurking down there in the bottom of the mind. There are monsters. There are dragons. There are strange beasts. And we're never quite sure that one of those beasts is not going to leap out of the mud and wrap its coils around us and crush us and devour us. This can happen. And so there's a fear there. Now, one of the things that we do, or that we have as Buddhist monastics, is that we have a code of conduct we call the Vinaya. And this is one of the things that really marks out, if we look in our modern world. You know, of course, there are many people who are interested in meditation and spiritual practice and so on and so forth. But one of the things which really marks out the Buddhist monastics is that discipline. We have this code of conduct which we take very seriously, which we believe was, at least in its essence, was laid down by the Buddha himself. And I think that there are good historical reasons to believe that that's the case. And all of you know that I'm a fairly ruthless historical critical scholar, and if I'm convinced that something is not, you know, taught by the Buddha, or we don't have reason for it, I'm quite happy to say so. But in this case, I think that it is likely that the Patimokkha rules, and at least the essential procedures of the Khandakas, were actually laid down by the Buddha. And these give us a support and they give us some boundaries and some strength when we go in to grapple with that monster. And they give us there's of course this problem of this kind of disjunction between the external image which we present and then the internal reality. Okay? So this is the slightly tawdry fact that we kind of wear the same robe as the Buddha and have the same hairstyle as the Buddha, but most of us are not quite as purified and liberated and full of good qualities as the Buddha was, to put it mildly. And so there's this kind of disjunction between the image that we're presenting and the reality of our own swampy and defiled minds. So this is a problem that we try to work with, and if we practice well and we can overcome our defilements little bit by little bit by little bit as we practice, then yeah, we get there, you know, and I think it is possible to realize the same purity, the same freedom that the Buddha himself realized. I believe that there are monks and nuns who have realized this, many of them, and I believe that everybody here can realize that same purity. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be, running this monastery if I didn't honestly and truly believe that to the depths of my heart. This is the only reason why I'm doing this. And yet so this is why in the commentaries it talks about like the different ways of relating to the alms food. Like, you know, we're using the alms food as a debtor, because you're presenting as it were the face of the Buddha, but not being oneself enlightened, then one's using the alms food as a debtor, and one's only truly worthy of one's offerings and so on when one's enlightened, when one's an arahant, is what it means, is a worthy one. So it's a bit like, you know, you have to take out a student loan when you're at university, and you have to get this loan, and then afterwards you have to pay it off. And I read reading an article in the Guardian today about the persistence of gender inequality, and they said that in England it takes men an average of 11 years to pay off their student loans, and women take 16 years to pay off their student loan. So hopefully the same won't be true in the Sangha when we have our bhikkhuni order, that the path to arahantship will be as smooth and easy for the bhikkhunis as it is for the bhikkhus. Not that it's ever smooth and easy. But while there is this this disjunct, this lack of complete personal purity of consciousness, we still have defilements and so on. The Vinaya helps us to bridge that gap. So the Vinaya, if we want to play with this metaphor and extend it out a bit further, the Vinaya, keeping the Vinaya, is a bit like somebody who's at least making the regular repayments on their debt. They haven't paid it off completely, but at least they're being honest about it. and not getting further into debt. So that's what the veneer is like. And it gives us some very clear boundaries in dealing with the monsters of the mind. There's certain, for example, there's certain, when we want to deal with kinds of defilements, there are different strategies that we use at different times and for different reasons. And some of these are talked about in the Sambhansava Sutta, Majjhima 2. And some kinds of defilements and things that provoking defilements we can avoid. Okay, so we just don't go near them, we avoid them as if we avoid stepping on a snake. Or we avoid like a wild bull or something like that. Okay, so there's certain things that we just don't do for monastics. We don't do killing, okay? We don't do stealing, we don't do sex. And so we just sort of step back from those kind of realms and there's quite clear boundaries on those things. But in other things, the boundaries are not so clear and we need... and there are grey areas. And of course anyone who's got any familiarity with the veneer would know that much of the veneer and much of the debate and discussion about different areas of the veneer is precisely to do with these grey areas. That things that are not necessarily 100% clear or obvious how they're supposed to be applied. And that's very natural. We're talking about human behaviour here, which is very complex. And the veneer in many things is very specific. It's very contextualized. It mentions specific forms of conduct which are not to be done. And then one is left with many things where there perhaps aren't clear or explicit guidelines and where we have to try to make the best judgment that we can. But these things, by providing those guidelines and by exercising our mind in that way, what's not so important in those cases that we necessarily all come to the same conclusion or that there even be one right answer to those things. What's more important is that we can engage with that process of reflecting about what these rules are, what they mean, and how they could be interpreted, should be interpreted, and so on. And in doing that, we begin to understand how it is that our defilements, the motivations in our mind that lead to suffering, how it is that these express themselves through actions of body and speech, and how tricky they are. Okay, and as soon as we feel like we've kind of closed off one avenue, they'll come leaking out another avenue, another way. So this takes a good deal of kind of diligence and work to try to understand these things. But the positive side of that is that there's a standard and an expectation which is both an external expectation in terms of what does the Buddhist community expect of us, and also an internal expectation in how do we feel that we are living well and practicing in the appropriate way as a monk or nun. And that of course is if we feel that we are being sincere and have a sense of integrity around our vinaya practice. And it's important that we not set our sights too low. I remember when I was in Malaysia a number of years ago and talking with Bhante Agachitta, and he was saying that how, because there was these discussions about the poor, you know, the problems with the Sangha in Thailand, and some of the lay people in Thailand were quoted as saying, you know, it's really hard for us to keep precepts these days. If only the monks would at least keep the 5 precepts, we'd be happy. Even if they do that much. Because we can't keep 5 precepts. So if the monks can keep 5 precepts, then that's good enough for us. Well, it's not good enough, all right? If you're going to be bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, then you should keep all your precepts and try to understand both the letter and the spirit of them. And as Bhikkhu Bodhi said, to practice both the letter and the spirit, but above all, the spirit. And I think that was a very beautiful way of putting it. And when the Vinaya is practiced rightly, when we understand it in its context, not as the whole of the Buddhist path, not as the essence of what it means to be a Buddhist monk or nun, but as a set of rules, prescriptions, principles, which it aids and guides and supports for us to know what the right kind of conduct is. So these are something which we should see as a gift to us from the Buddha, not as a cage. And they give us that kind of strength. They give us like an armor, which can help to protect us when we're doing battle with the dragon. And when they're used properly, when they function in the right way, these rules of the Vinaya will they move us towards that state of purity and that state of freedom. There's a very beautiful sutta where Visakha is being taught by the Buddha about keeping the 8 precepts. And so she's to reflect when she keeps the 8 precepts that, you know, today I refrain from killing living beings, just like the arahants for all of their life will not kill a living being. So too in this day I will not kill any living being. Just as the arahants refrain from stealing, so too today I also will refrain from stealing. And the same kind of reflection applies to the Parimokkha precepts and the other precepts of the Vinaya, that they are the way of life of the arahants. And they move us and support us towards, they like nudge us towards that form of the enlightened being. And that person who can realize the freedom within themselves. So there always has to be this sense of spontaneity within one's mind and in one's response to the Dhamma. There has to be a creative response to the Dhamma. If there's not, it won't have that zing. It'll be like the champagne without the bubbles. It's like an angel without the halo, a king without the crown. It doesn't have that inspiration. And so if we let it be just the rules, then we end up with like something fairly drab. We end up with a drab life. But remember that what the Buddha called this life, he called it the Brahmacharya, the holy life. And that Brahma is precisely that inspired spiritual energy. That's what Brahma means. And back at the very roots of the word Brahma, in the Rig Veda and so on, the word basically comes from a root meaning to expand something or to enhance it, and it refers to the the energized or the sacred aspect of things, when they're enhanced with a divine inspiration or the kind of the numinous. So this is like, you know, you think about it, it's like the difference between an ordinary pine tree and a Christmas tree. Okay, the Christmas tree is decorated with the tinsel and so on. And that's the mind with Brahma, is that it's an expanded mind. It's a mind with a glow around it, with a halo. It's a mind which is infused with this divine energy. And when my friends Siddhanta and Gunawiro were ordained, their preceptor, Ajahn Chökyam Mahamon, told them the story. He said that the life gone forth is like bananas. And in Thai they have a dish called Gloi Bot Chi, which means bananas ordained as a nun. Because in Thailand the nuns wear white. And so they make this dish where they cook bananas in sweet coconut milk. And so the bananas are in this sweet coconut milk, so they look like they're wearing the white robes of a nun. And he's saying that just as the bananas, when they were ordained as a nun, then they're much sweeter and much more delicious and much richer than ordinary bananas. Then the same way when we've ordained, our ordained life is much sweeter and much richer and much more delicious than ordinary life. And so this is what puts the Brahma into Acharya. It's what puts the holy into the life. And so we have to, because each of us have our own history, our own story, our own background, we need to find what is that Brahma for us, what is that sense of divine inspiration, what is that spark, where do we get that sense of uplift, that sense of joy, Ajahn Brahm calls Zipiriruda. I remember Ajahn Jnana saying, because once he was travelling with Ajahn Brahm, and he said it was horrible. You know, Ajahn Brahm would get up early, first thing in the morning, and go, zippity doo da. Ajahn Jnana would be like, oh, just shut up with him. But it's the zippity doo da. Where do we find that? We have to look for that. You can't formularize it, you can't market it, you can't package it, you can't reduce it. This is the irreducible element, you can't analyze it. But you can touch it, you can experience it, you can live it. So this is my little talk for you this evening on Zipiti Buddha. So I offer this for your enjoyment and inspiration. And does anyone have any comments or questions? Okay. Let's finish.
Sati panna
madhavato